Let's go to the Ngātahuanga Sound Archives, where we're wishing happy 80th birthday to the listener today.
Winter time is listening time, and the Broadcasting Service has programs for your pleasure and enjoyment during the winter evenings. For better listening, select the programs that appeal to you most with the aid of the New Zealand listener. The listener is published each week with the following week's programs in advance.
Yes, the Listener magazine is 80 years old this week, and in today's trip to the sound archives of Ngātahuanga Sound and Vision, we're going back pre-internet, when that weekly magazine was an essential source of information on New Zealand cultural life. It held the monopoly on TV and radio listings until the 1980s. It published top 20 music charts and, of course, reviewed books, albums, theatre and film. Sarah Johnson from Ngātahuanga is here to take us back. Hi, Sarah.
Kia ora, Jesse. Yes, way back to 1939 when the first edition came out, so just before the start of World War II. And, you know, as the name The Listener suggests, it was aimed at radio listeners because, of course, no TV back then. And it was a way to find out what was going to be on the radio, which station you could tune into and when. So, you know, in that time, this was really important information. And that's illustrated by this commercial coming up, which is from the magazine, and it dates also from the 1950s.
Here's a man who may be a menace in your home. Listen to his superlative performance as he hunts the dial for his favourite radio programmes.
We've a happy coincidence.
It's a proven fire stop.
You know, there's one sure way of curing that fellow. Buy him a copy, or better still, buy a subscription of The Listener, and show him the easy way to find his favourite programme. And while he listens happily to his choice, take time off yourself to read The Listener's many absorbing features. Don't be behind the times when The Listener can keep you informed on such topics as film reviews, the most timely recipes from Aunt Daisy's vast experience, articles of absorbing interest on current topics, and thumbnail sketches of radio's personalities. For a refreshing experience in the field of radio listening, combined with a host of attractive articles, you must buy The Listener. It's available now everywhere.
So those radio listings of what your upcoming programs in The Listener were provided, of course, by the Broadcasting Service, which conveniently also owned The Listener.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, the government of the day owned them both. The Broadcasting Service was an arm of the government, and it ensured that there was a monopoly on those listings for the magazine. So this was, you know, really desirable intellectual property back in the day, and competitors like newspapers and other magazines would complain from time to time about this monopoly. And of course, even more so when TV was launched in New Zealand in 1960, and The Listener then had a monopoly on those new mediums programs.
It's a good setup, eh? Good business model.
Absolutely. And, you know, The Listener, you know, to give it its credit, it was an incredibly powerful force, really, in moulding New Zealand culture in that era. You know, it published lots of our famous poets, gave them their first break, and authors, and all sorts of people who went on to have, you know, really significant careers got their start in The Listener. And it also had a long tradition of carrying, you know, fairly provocative editorials, and the correspondence page was kind of legendary too. It still is pretty, you know, there's some pretty great letters to the editor in it. So in the 1970s, there were some fairly left-leaning columns being published, and this upset the Prime Minister of the day, Robert Muldoon. He actually threatened to take away the magazine's monopoly on those listings, and that eventually happened, I think, during the Rogernomics era in the 1980s. I actually read while I was researching this today that The Listener invented the term Rogernomics, apparently. So that would be interesting if someone could prove that. Yeah.
There's probably already Thatcheronomics and Reaganomics, so it might not have been too much of a leap.
Not much of a stretch, but there you go. We'll give them credit.
Yeah.
So this next cut is from Ian Cross. He was the editor in the 1970s, in the start of the Muldoon era, and he explains in this cut how he viewed the magazine's role in stimulating debate in New Zealand through tackling some of those controversial sort of topic. So this is from an Insight documentary from 1979.
My whole view, editorial view, was to begin from your readers, begin from your country, begin from your country's people, and express their reactions, explain them sympathetically. Sometimes this took me strongly against prevailing trends, but I didn't mind that. But by doing this, I think I struck for the magazine a chord of recognition among many people that hadn't read the magazine before. Somehow or other, they felt represented by the magazine.
Why is the listener so often in the firing line?
Because it chooses the key subjects of the day and examines them, or attempts to examine them, in depth. And sometimes gives people with opinions, with a polemic view of the world, scope to express themselves. This strong form of journalism is inevitably going to produce a reaction. I think it's a very desirable reaction. I don't care whether the strong view is from the left or the right. I think New Zealand society needs stimulating, needs enlivening. And we need to be more conscious of our own opinions. One way of achieving that consciousness is to be exacerbated or annoyed by the opinions of other people, if you like. In other words, it's a contribution to a more stimulating and interesting society.
I'd agree with that. It's quite compelling, isn't he? Ian Cross, editor of The Listener during the 1970s.
He went on, I think, after being editor, to be the head of, well, today he'd be the head of RNZ. He was the head of the NZBC. So, yes, he was an interesting, and of course, famous author too. The God Boy, I think he wrote. So readership of the magazine doubled during Cross's time as editor. And this was partly due to a host of new columnists and cartoonists who he hired. And they went on to sort of become, you know, real icons of New Zealand life in the 1970s. And we're talking about people like cartoonist Tom Scott, Rosemary McLeod, who used to have a very well-known sort of column and cartoon, that usually on sort of, you know, 70s feminist kind of topics, and Burton Silver. Now, people might remember Burton Silver. He had the long-running cartoon series Bogor. Do you remember it?
Yeah, I do.
So for those who don't remember, it was a cartoon strip that appeared weekly, and it featured
Was he a forestry worker or something?
Yeah, he was a forestry worker. He was sort of this lonely little woodsman. He had a hard hat and, you know, singlet and gumboots, and he was, you know, out there amongst the pine trees. And his companions were a hedgehog and a snail, and the hedgehog and snail were very fond of marijuana, which they were growing in his pine plantations. And Burton, I read an interview with him in which he said he gave the idea for the Bogor cartoon to Ian Cross, who loved the concept and said, yes, let's go with the series, without realising there was going to be this heavy marijuana habit involved. And he was furious when he found out, but in the end sort of compromised with Burton, who and said to him, okay, the hedgehog can grow the pot, but not Bogor himself.
Great.
So this set up, you know, this nice conflict between the characters, which worked quite well. So to end today, this is an interview from 1977, very deadpan style. This is listener cartoonist Burton Silver, and he's explaining how he feels that encouraging marijuana consumption by hedgehogs could help New Zealand's pastoral industry.
Thanks, Sarah.
You see, every year on our roads, we're killing tens of thousands of hedgehogs, and thereby we're destroying a very important means of controlling pasture pests. Now, the reason that hedgehogs are killed in such great numbers on our roads is that when they're disturbed or frightened, they curl up. So instead of running away from approaching car headlights, they curl up and are run over. But when a hedgehog is stoned on marijuana, one of the effects is that it induces a kind of mild state of paranoia, something that's in fact well known amongst pot smokers. And this makes the hedgehog less confident of the preservation effect of its curling up response. The psychology of this goes something like this. When a hedgehog's straight, it says to himself, "Now, if anything happens to me, I can just curl up and I'll be okay." But when he's stoned and more paranoid, more worried, he says to himself, "Now, if anything happens to me, I might not have time to curl up." And as a result of this, when a hedgehog's stoned and in an area of potential danger, like on a road, he just dashes straight across, whoosh, straight over the other side. And this, of course, works in the hedgehog's favour, and it protects him from being run over. Now, if hedgehogs are not stoned, they're much more likely to be run over. And if they get run over, they can't eat piranha and grass grubs. And I think, therefore, that New Zealand's future agricultural viability could well depend to a large extent on our planting large amounts of marijuana in pasture areas in order to turn on as many hedgehogs as possible.
The gentle humour of listener cartoonist Burton Silver, that's in 1977. Later, he wrote an internationally best-selling book called Why Cats Paint.